I think we will go ahead and get started, call the meeting of the California Water Commission to order. The chairman, Chairman Commissioner Byrne is going to be late, and the vice chairman, Commissioner Del Bosque, is recovering from what I'm told is a minor shoulder injury, so they've asked that I would at least open the meeting until the chairman gets here, and we'll expect him in about an hour or so. First, before we get started, I do want to thank Metropolitan Water District for hosting this today. Commissioner Quintero and I were talking about what a fabulous facility this is. Makes us covet more customers, I think, or something. But so let's do roll call, Paula.
Present.
Here.
Commissioner Herrera.
Here.
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 Okay. Item three on the agenda is the approval of the minutes of the July 15-16 meeting. They were included in the packet. Any comments or questions? If not, a motion?
Yes, motion.
Motion from Commissioner Ball.
Second.
And a second from Commissioner Daniels. Roll call.
Yes.
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 Okay, thank you. Executive officers report item four. Paula?
Yes, just a couple of items. I had mentioned before that we were advertising to fill the attorney four position, which Maureen King is acting in. That's been re-advertised. We are also in the process of looking into hiring a information officer specifically to handle a lot of the communication and media and outreach that we've been dealing with a lot lately at the commissioner and staff level. We are finalizing the scope of work for a new consultant contract and making great progress on updating the regulations section of the website and a couple of other items, which I will leave for Jenny Moore, who will be covering those in her presentation.
Any questions from any of the commissioners? Okay, thank you. We'll go to item five on the agenda, which is the welcome. And Commissioner Daniels, I will call upon you.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, there you go.
Our commission has spent some time visiting different parts of the state because the work of the commission obviously affects all of California. And how could we have meetings throughout California and not come to Southern California? We definitely appreciate the graciousness of Metropolitan Water District in hosting us here. But I want to welcome you all as somebody who's lived in Los Angeles for over 40 years now. I've mentioned it before, but many of us who are born and raised in California, but many of us come here from somewhere else and then become Californians almost immediately. And I count myself as among those from the time I came to Los Angeles a while ago. Los Angeles is known to many people for a lot of things. I think people think of its palm trees and maybe its Hollywood signs, but the largeness of California, and Southern California in particular, is significant. The LA County region being about 4,500 square miles, 12 million people, just LA County alone, 88 cities, and when you think about what it means to supply and manage water to an area of that size, it takes some significant creativity, which is really what I think Los Angeles is about, and the Los Angeles region is its people. And what we know about it, including the fact that it's probably the Southern California region alone, the 16th largest world economy by itself, the LA region, the third largest in gross metropolitan product behind only Tokyo and New York. When you think about what it takes to manage the people and the needs of that region, particularly when it comes to water, I think what it speaks to is the wealth of talent and the people here. So I want to welcome you with pride for who, you know, what Los Angeles represents and the people of Los Angeles. Those of you who have been able to attend here today, thank you for coming. I know we're going to hear soon from the Metropolitan Water District, and I can't say much more than the fact that they will represent what the statistics are for Metropolitan Water District, the significance of the size of the district as well as the efforts that they're making. But I also want to compliment and thank Jeff Keitlinger, who's been the general manager for the Metropolitan Water District for over 10 years now and has shown significantly exemplary leadership, for which we're all grateful. So thank you, Jeff, for that, and thank you for hosting us here. I don't know if he comes next or not. Was that a good introduction?
We'll call him up at public comment time. So, sorry, Jeff.
Sorry, it sure seemed like it, didn't it, the way I said it.
A couple more things. I think on behalf of the commission entirely, we do appreciate very much being here and look forward to the comments here in a few minutes. Also under this agenda, item 5 is an opportunity for the members of the commission to report on any meetings or conversations you've had relative to commission business since the last meeting. Do we have any reports of meetings or workshops attended?
Respect to commission business, but I did meet yesterday with Eric Averett of the Rosedale Rio Bravo Water District to talk about the operations of the Kern Water Bank.
And I went down to Semitropic a few weeks ago and met with Jason there.
And likewise, I've had several telephone conversations with representatives of the Semitropic interests relative to their proposed project. Also, on August 10th, I was asked to attend as a commissioner a meeting with the Fresno County Administrative Office and a couple of the elected Board of Supervisors. Some of you may know that the County of Fresno is leading the creation of a joint powers agency to create an entity with some of the neighboring counties that can look at local storage, including the proposed temperance project. And I attended that meeting and tried to provide some clarity on process and timeline. And then I was able to attend with Commissioner Curtin the public workshop held in Kern County that evening. About 30 people, I think, from the public present. And the usual tone and scope of questions. It was very well done by the staff. So, if there are not any other reports or any questions, we'll move to public testimony. I do have one speaker card. This is the opportunity for the public to address the commission. The speaker card, I think, given the size of the audience, will not be necessary. So if others want to follow this first individual, please do so when I call upon you. We're going to try to control the time here to a handful of minutes, 3 or 4 minutes. But the card I have is from Connor Everts. Connor, thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Los Angeles. And we tried hard to get more people here. They may be on the way, as you may have mentioned. If you haven't been here the night before, it's a challenge to get downtown. Maybe a worse challenge to get back west. So my name's Connor Everts. I represent the Environmental Water Caucus, a statewide organization of environmental community and fishermen groups, including tribes, and we've been involved in this process for a long time. I also want to say personally, maybe I can add some size to the audience personally here, but I have been the president of the Ojai Basin Groundwater Agency. We actually put meters in a small area that's an anomaly in Southern California in that we have remnant ag and our own groundwater. That was in the early 90s at the end of the drought. I was also a drought coordinator for the City of Pasadena Municipal Water Department, where we saved 27%. And I guess I'm showing my age that I've been doing this for so long. But we seem to be having the same conversations over and over again. And one of them, in terms of when you look at the water storage money in Prop 1, and we do have a seat on your advisory committee, is that you need to look no further than the San Fernando Valley here in Los Angeles area. Represents a huge potential. We've been having a discussion about cleaning it up for a long time with LADWP, but until we actually move forward on that, we're missing a huge opportunity with placing not only stormwater, but a long overdue recycled water program that we've been working on for many years and getting to the point where we have public acceptance of it as well. I think we're past that point finally. So there are many opportunities in Southern California. I think we've led the way. The Metropolitan Water District, by offering rebates and incentives, showed that there was a tsunami of response. In 38 years of doing this, I've never seen the kind of media response and the response from people in general who want to talk about water and want to blame almonds, which I say it's not that simple. But there is a huge opportunity right now. And I don't think it ends with El Nino, but I think right now we need to do all we can and engage the public. So I look forward to you hiring an information or communications officer and working with you on that. The other organization that I represent is called Green LA, made up of 103 organizations, a community organization throughout LA. We have a water committee that meets regularly, and they were the ones that actually sent out notice of this as well. So again, thank you. Look to us for Southern California for an example of what can be done, because we have managed our groundwater successfully. We have done recycling programs, especially in Orange County, successfully, and we have been the leaders in not only doing conservation, but involving community-based organizations in that effort. So it's really some equity. However, we still lack the human right to water in little towns like Maywood that have polluted groundwater, don't have access to safe, clean, affordable drinking water, and that remains a priority issue for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the commissioners? Certainly appreciate your participation in the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. That's a very important and critical part of all of what we're doing. Any other members of the public at this point would like to speak to the commission? If not, I think we will have opportunity after the various agenda items, again, to hear from you on specific issues. So with that, Jeff, we appreciate your patience, but we will welcome you to present to the Commission on activities of the Metropolitan Water District. And thank you again.
Thank you, David. It's very unusual for me to be sitting on this side of the podium here. So welcome to Metropolitan Southern California. We've been in this building since 2000, and it's been a great location for us, I mean, with all the transportation. I'm an eighth-generation Californian, Southern Californian, which is pretty rare, but it's a tremendous place, home here. So I was asked to give you guys a little overview about Metropolitan. I believe you can see it on your screens. We also have it behind you. And I'm just going to give you a quick overview of what's going on with Metropolitan and a little bit about us. This is our service area right there. If you see, it seems like a relatively small piece of California. It's a little over 5,000 square miles, but you basically have one in every two Californians. So Metropolitan is the water wholesaler to all of Southern California. We serve 19 million people. We serve about roughly a little over a billion gallons of water every single day, to almost 2 billion gallons a day. And this is, we supply a lot of treated water. We operate five treatment plants that provide treated water, drinking water, to all of Southern California. But we also supply raw water, which is used as replenishment for keep our basins and to keep our other supplies throughout Southern California. Over a $1 trillion economy here. The way we are governed is we have 26 member agencies. Each of them gets at least one member on our board. That represents the seats you see here. We have a 38-member board. That then sits on our board. We then serve water to retailers. So the City of Los Angeles Department of Water Power is a retailer of ours. So it keeps my job relatively simple. I have 26 bills a month that go out. They then have to go collect from 4 million residents. But then many of ours, because Paula mentioned 80-some cities in L.A. County alone, originally the model was each city was going to join Metropolitan. So instead, we had them start forming water districts that they could then have a consortium of 30 cities, which would then have one representative on our board. 38's unwieldy enough. We didn't really feel like there's over 300 some retailers we serve water to, so that would be a slightly bigger board than we have today. The water we supply, Metropolitan supplies a little more than half of all the water consumed in Southern California. We have about 4 million acre feet of water is the demand a year Metropolitan supplies. in a year 1.8 to 2.2 million acre feet, depending on the average, you know, the swings of our local supply. The makeup of that is, so about 45% local, although to be fair, we're kind of fudging on that local. We call Owens Valley supply, which is City of Los Angeles owned supply. We lump that in local, but it's really not terribly local. It's coming from about 350 miles northeast of here. But the other big chunks are the State Water Project, about 30% of Southern California's water coming from Northern California and the Feather River Basin, and Colorado River, 25% of our water supply. And was really the reason Metropolitan was created, was to go out and build and develop the Colorado River Aqueduct in 1928. And that was our original mission. And then our mission expanded to become the largest contractor on the State Water Project. If you look at it hydrologically, here's the imported water supply. You see the upper Colorado River Basin coming down through Lake Mead and then into the lower basin. We pick it up at Lake Havasu and Metropolitan-owned and operated Colorado River Aqueduct, bring it 250 miles west into our service area. And that has been the backbone of our system for 70-some years. And in a year like this, the last couple of years of this California drought, our Colorado River Aqueduct has been operating full, and it has been essential to keeping our lifestyle down here in Southern California. And then you see the Northern Sierras draining into Lake Oroville, into the Feather River Basin. That comes down the California Aqueduct. You know, and whenever I look at our water supply, about every 30 years, Southern California has had to go out and get a new water supply. 1900, they developed the Owens Valley supply. 1930s, Metropolitan developed the Colorado River Aqueduct. 1960, the State Water Project in partnership with Pat Brown. And 1990 was the first year we actually had to ration water in Southern California. And it makes sense. The growth in Southern California has meant a little more than each generation has had to get out and go get a new water supply. For us, the lesson of the 1990 drought was that we probably were no longer going to engineer, go dam, and build, and transport a new water supply. And that's when we developed integrated resources planning in the 1990s. And our model became, we're going to try and firm up our imported supplies of State Water Project and Colorado River water, keep those stable, but all new growth from 1990 onward is going to have to be accommodated with local supplies. And that's when we really started focusing on regional targets for conservation, recycling, groundwater recovery, and to get us through dry years, more storage, which I know is near and dear to your commission's heart. So we'll get to that in a second. But if you just look at this is one thing we developed in the 1990s, was a local resources program. So Metropolitan we were created as an imported water wholesaler, supplemental water provider to Southern California. The rethinking of our mission in the 1990s was that we were going to actually now take that money from the sale of water and steer it towards recycled projects, groundwater recovery, conservation. And here's just a map of all the current programs that Metropolitan has developed throughout Southern California. When you see we're delivering right now between recycled water and groundwater recovery about 420,000 acre feet of water a year, that's about 10% of the demand in the region is now coming from those supplies. That is how we've been managing to deal with cuts and losses of imported water, the loss of Owens Valley supply to Los Angeles. And then, of course, conservation is throughout our entire service area, so that's just shown in yellow. And if you see this game plan that we developed in the 90s, it's pretty successful. We've added 5 million people. We were serving, in 1990, we served 14 million people. We serve 19 million people today. So we've added 5 million people to Southern California. And if you see our retail demand, it's pretty much flat. So as we've added population, we've been able to cap our demand for new supplies. And that actually, even though we've lost imported supplies as well, we've been able to backfill that and cover that with other supplies. One of the key decisions we made in 1992 was that our demands were such that we have to have a backup supply, and that became storage. In 1977 drought, Metropolitan actually backed off our State Water Project supplies, allowed that water to be redirected by then Governor Jerry Brown to Marin. And we did is we ramped up our pumping full bore on the Colorado River Aqueduct, and we could mix and match our supplies hydrologically. Colorado River wasn't in drought, Northern California was, And so we were able to actually lend water, give water to Northern California that actually went to farming regions in Marin County. In 1990, we didn't have that luxury. When Metropolitan ran short, we ran our Colorado River Aqueduct full bore, but our population and our own demands had grown such that we could no longer get by a drought by just mixing and matching supplies. And that's when we realized we had to have storage as well. So if you look at where we were in 1980, we basically could store about 350,000 acre feet. Today, Metropolitan has the ability to store over 5 million acre feet. We did that. The biggest cornerstone on it is our Diamond Valley, our Diamond Valley Lake project. That came on in line in 2000. It holds 810,000 acre feet out in Riverside County. It's now down to about 40% capacity, being pulled down because of the drought. But that was our own $2 billion project that we built, our own reservoir, to just manage as Metropolitans. But many of these others are cooperative programs. We have groundwater storage contracts and programs. We store water in Arvin Edison, in Semitropic, in Coachella Valley. We store water in Nevada. Nevada stores water with us. We store water in Lake Mead. Metropolitan has we crafted an arrangement with the Bureau of Reclamation in 2007, so we would have access to Lake Mead storage. And so we now have the ability to store 5 million acre feet. This kind of gives you a picture of how it's worked through the drought. So in 2006 to 2009, we went into drought. You see that orange bar at the bottom? That's what we consider emergency storage. We are in earthquake country here in Southern California. Most of us and throughout California are, frankly. And so we keep 6 months' supply over the mountain ranges in Southern California. Both the State Water Project, Colorado River Aqueduct, both cross the San Andreas Fault, very susceptible to an outage of 3 to 6 months, who knows, in a major earthquake. We always keep 6 months' supply of drinking water in Southern California. That is there for emergency purposes. And then for drought management, that's those greenish bars. And so you see how in 2006 we had a little over 2 million acre feet. We've pulled it down to 2009 to 1 million acre feet of operating storage. Once we kind of hit roughly about 1 million acre feet, that's usually when we start taking actions. So in 2009, we went into an allocation, which is our speak for rationing. But because the retailers kind of ration at the consumer, so we allocate as a wholesaler to all our member agencies. That year, we did a 10% mandatory cutback across Southern California. The response was pretty phenomenal. We got about a 15 to 20%. And you see, by 2010 and 11, when the weather got a little wetter, we were able to start rebuilding our storage. By 2012, we're back into drought, and then you see it start pulling down. At the end of this year, we expect to be about somewhere in the 700,000-800,000 acre foot range. So we have been pulling down that storage again. What have we done? We've gone back into some sort of allocation. This is something our staff has prepared. I think mainly because I think our board got tired of looking at that same map of California that's showing the whole thing dark red, as in serious or extreme drought. So this is intended to show chronologically percentage of the state. And so you can see in October of 14, it's been pretty static for the last year. We were a little over 50% in exceptional drought, 75-80% of the state in exceptional extreme. And while it's improved slightly, it's not much. We're still obviously the bulk of the state in exceptional and extreme drought. And of course, you've seen all these pictures of Lake Oroville. This is our State Water Project's main supply. A little better on the Colorado River. Colorado River has been in 15-year drought. 2000, we started in drought on the Colorado River up until then, a pretty wet period. But you see that actually the last year has actually been for the Colorado River, given this 15-year drought cycle we are in, has shown some improvement. We're now in about a slight drought condition for the current year. However, the last 15 years has pulled down the overall storage on the Colorado River by more than half. Both Lake Mead and Lake Powell Lake Mead is at its lowest level since they filled it in the 1930s, and Lake Powell is at less than half full. So the Colorado River system is still in drought conditions. Here's just a snapshot of Lake Mead behind Hoover Dam, and that water level up there was 1998, when the lake was completely full. The Colorado River system had over 60 million acre feet in it total. pretty phenomenal. It's now down into the, it's below 30, it's in the 20s. And you can see how it just dropped. It's now the lowest record. You see that level down there. And if you've seen any pictures of Lake Mead, you see this big white bathtub ring around it. The size of Lake Mead is phenomenal. Every foot it drops equals 100,000 acre feet. So a foot in Lake Mead equals 100,000, and it's dropped over 100 feet. Some of the things we've done here at Metropolitan, we've gone back into allocation. We came in with a 15% cutback for our member agencies. We chose that number as targeted at the wholesale level to lead to that would hopefully then accommodate at the consumer level the 25% cutback required by the governor and the state water board. Pleased to report so far. Since the last 2 months, Southern California is in the, mid-20s. We're in the mid-20s, about 27% cutback at the moment, reduction. Parts of our region are hitting their 30% cutback, so doing quite well. One of the other things Mr. Everts referred to, our board looked at what sort of a shovel-ready, immediate thing we can do in a drought. We're already doing conservation. We're already doing recycled water projects. We're working. Those are long things to get online. You had a lot of consumer demand to respond to the drought. You had the governor's call for the 25% cutback. Well, our annual budget for conservation is typically $20 million. And that $20 million a year goes towards rebates on high-efficiency toilets, front-loading washing machines, and a dollar a square foot to take out turf. And that $20 million actually met all our demands. In fact, usually the consumer demand was a little under that $20 million a year. In the last 18 months, you know, we went through the $20 million like that. I went to the board and said, we need to add some more money into it. So we put in $100 million. So that's already five times larger than our annual budget for conservation rebates. We went through that in 6 months. So I said, I think we got more demand out there than we've ever seen before. What do you want to do? And so we decided to pull out of our reserves $350 million and said it's in a drought, people are responding. And we thought that would last the rest of the year. And we were done with the $350 million in about 8 weeks. Phenomenal response. And about the way it worked was about more than $60 million of it was devices, things like the toilets and the washing machines. The rest of it, the other $390 million, was on the turf program. And it's phenomenal. It's probably somewhere between, you know, we're working with UCLA, and we're trying to get some academic study of it, but we probably have touched, we believe, almost 10% of every household in Southern California has put in either a new device or a new turf. And it's really changing the landscape and feel of Southern California. It's one of those big jolts to the system. We did 20 years worth of budgeting in an 18-month period. So we will see at long term what the effect is, but it was the biggest jolt to that system we thought we could do. And we actually have a waiting list, and the demand is still out there. We just, frankly, don't have the money to keep going at this rate. We also spend about $1 million a year in outreach. This year, we're spending close to $6 million in outreach, and so you've probably seen some of this if you've been driving around Southern California. It's been a very successful program. You know, credit to Dee and Sue here for putting this together. But, the response has been pretty phenomenal. We've done some polling, and about 95-96% of our populace is basically saying, this is a serious drought, we need to do something about it. Never seen numbers like that in our business before. So just quick summary, we've done a lot of planning and a lot of investing the last 20-some years. It has paid off pretty well. We have we've taken some immediate steps, obviously put a lot of money in for immediate effects to deal with this drought. But we do urge you to look at these programs. We think the Cal Water Fix, more storage, these are things that are absolutely necessary. We've done them in Southern California. We need them to happen at the statewide level as well. With that, if you have any questions, otherwise we'd be welcome to Southern California. Welcome to Matt.
Thank you, Jeff. Anybody have any questions? Any of the commissioners? Comments? Paula?
Thank you. I told you so.
There we go. Thank you, Jeff, for the presentation. And one comment and then one question. I think that the increase in conservation, the interest of Angelenos in changing their habits with respect to landscape, the response to that speaks to what I was saying earlier, that the Southern California area, the people here are incredibly creative, responsive, reinventive. They're all seeing that it's time to change what our practices are, and they're stepping up. Given that landscape is about 40 to 50% of our water use in residential areas, the response has been tremendous. So it's great to see that, and thank you for stepping up that program. I wanted to talk to you, see if you could amplify on the recycling and then stormwater capture, because an El Nino is anticipated, hotly anticipated, especially for Southern California. And obviously, if we have maximized our stormwater capture and recharge, it'd be a great way not to let that water go to waste in one way. So that and the, I know you have 75 recycling projects, but is there, what if you could amplify in the plan to increase that?
So we developed targets as a region for recycled water, and we're on track for that. But one of the lessons we're learning is most of these were relatively small-scale programs, and they've been using the recycled water at places like golf courses and parks and cemeteries and things like that. And we've really picked off most of those relatively easier to do, less expensive projects throughout Southern California. Orange County is doing indirect potable reuse, where they're putting it in the groundwater basin and eventually pumping it back up. And to have more recycled water, that's going to be the key for us. We're going to have to do much more of that type of program. Those become larger scale projects. They, instead of 1,500 acre feet type projects, they become the 30,000, 60,000 acre foot projects. Much larger scale and much more institutional issues, as you have to then work with the groundwater managers, local basins, local projects, and usually metropolitan as well. And they've been more challenging to pull off, I think, probably more from the institutional side than from the technical side. It's fairly straightforward technically. Orange County had only two institutions working in that one, Orange County San and Orange County Water District, with metropolitan subsidies. So the next challenge, we're looking very closely at the Central Basin area and the San Fernando Basin, very promising, and we are in process of trying to develop plans to do that, and we're hopeful we can make progress on those over the next few years. The stormwater capture side of the equation, we do quite a bit of it up in our local mountains. Most of that then gets fed into the San Gabriel Valley. The whole San Gabriel Valley, you can see that whole kind of eastern part of the San Gabriel Valley of Los Angeles area, it basically gets about 10 to 20% of their water from metropolitan. The rest is local, and it's through a managed basin that is all stormwater capture off the San Gabriel Mountains. Same thing is true to a smaller extent in San Fernando, Orange County as well. So we do, of that 30 to 40% of that local supply, it really is stormwater capture and regulation to our groundwater basins in Southern California. To grow that further, there's a couple estimates out there that it could be anywhere from, on the low end, about 200,000 acre feet, on the high end, maybe a million or so acre feet. Part of the challenge is our plumbing. This was a very flood-prone region. We get something like 12 to 14 inches of rain a year, but it usually comes in about 2 weeks. And we used to have devastating floods throughout Southern California, and it was a huge national project in the 1950s to develop a stormwater system to get that water out and stop flooding out big tracts of Southern California. In the 1950s, they put in the LA River and the huge concrete. It's going to take a long time to kind of re-engineer that and do that. And there are probably some limits to how you can do it. But anyway, 200,000, maybe a million. It's part of our IRP process is to look at what are the type projects we can invest in over this next five-year period. We're right now in the process of updating it. We update our IRP every 5 years. So we're in the middle of our 2015 update. Goal is to have that completed by the end of this year. And stormwater capture is one of the emphasis points. We have some challenges in our plumbing here in Southern California.
Any questions? Right. Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Before we go to item 8, I did get a note here, and I think it's a function of the morning and the travel issues, but there's another member of the public who would like to address the commission. So With the commission's indulgence, I'll call upon you if you'd introduce yourself, please.
Sure. Hi. Thank you for being here in Los Angeles. My name is Corrine Mandelbaum. I work with Environment Now. We are a nonprofit foundation in West Los Angeles that's been here since 1989. And very much focused on groundwater resources and groundwater protection over the past 8 years, looking at ways to maximize groundwater storage. So I appreciate you coming here to Los Angeles. I just want to share a bit about the successes Los Angeles and the Southern California region have had with groundwater storage. I'm sure that you know that over 90% of the adjudicated basins in California are here in Southern California. It has allowed for considerable sophistication in governance structures and use of groundwater as a critical part of water supply portfolios throughout Southern California. Here in LA County, over 18 of the local water agencies rely on groundwater solely for the purposes of supplying groundwater or drinking water to their service areas. And there are several other water agencies that are looking to their groundwater basins as the primary supply source for their drinking water. And so I wanted to talk about also the multi-benefits that the groundwater basins are providing, not just drinking water supply, but the seawater barriers that they have provided throughout our coastal areas, opportunities for recharge of reclaimed water and reused storm water. Jeff had mentioned the world-renowned reclaimed IPR plant in Orange County. In Long Beach, there's the Water Replenishment District, which has been recharging storm water for decades as well. It also provides habitat for wildlife, and it's not vulnerable to the levels of evaporation that we're seeing are surface storage areas. So we've been a big proponent of improving upon and maximizing those groundwater basins. And it's not without our challenges. The region has been the hub of many industries, polluting industries in the past, and so there is a lot of contamination and remediation to be done. There is overdraft in some of the groundwater basins throughout the Southern California region. And this is just a reflection of what you see throughout the state. I think it's more severe in other parts of the state, certainly the Central Valley area. But I wanted to urge you all in your role on the commission to share the lessons of Southern California, the successes and the challenges with the counterparts throughout the state. Share how important and critical groundwater has been to maintaining our standard of living, to being a critical part of our water supply portfolios, and urge the investment in improving and maximizing those groundwater resources statewide. There needs to be a lot more accountability. There needs to be a standard metric where all groundwater basin managers are looking at the same metrics in use and in use over time, and the groundwater, the surface to elevation levels, so that we can see progress in the amount of groundwater that's left in there, the amount of groundwater that can be sustainably used. And similarly, investments in remediation need to happen, some accountability for discharges and preventing those discharges from degrading the groundwater resources further. So thank you for your time. Thank you for being here in Los Angeles.
Thank you. Any questions? Appreciate that. Thank you very much. Before we go to the next item, and that is a great segue into the groundwater discussion that's next on the agenda, I will ask any other members of the public at this point caring to comment. Again, if not, as we go through specific items, we will again call for that. So item 8 on the agenda. Is an update on the implementation of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, and more specifically the review of the draft basin boundary emergency regulations. Stephen, I think you're up for this. Stephen Springhorn from the Department of Water Resources.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. As Commissioner Orth mentioned, my name is Stephen Springhorn. I work for the Department of Water Resources on the implementation team of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. And today I'll be going over a quick update, informational update on the basin boundary regulations, and then we'll go into a more detailed analysis and comment on the basin boundary regulations. And these basin boundary regulations are the first regulation in a set of two key regulations as part of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. So what I'd like to cover today, as I mentioned, a quick update on the process, where we are in our goal to adopting these regulations, then spend the majority of the time today discussing the draft regulations and really getting the Commission's feedback on these regulations, and then wrap up with next steps and where we go from here. So that update on the process. So this is a familiar slide that you've seen in previous presentations, but it's important for us to keep track of the different phases of implementation of this regulation. And we've, at each phase of this regulation, we've had extensive outreach and very valuable feedback from the initial scoping earlier this year, getting a common understanding of the issues and challenges with the existing basin boundaries, groundwater basin boundaries, as they are currently. We used that information to develop draft framework. Again, we went out to solicit comments from the public in three public listening sessions, and all of that has culminated with this draft emergency regulation in front of you. Again, in this phase, we will have an opportunity for three additional public meetings we'll be holding later this month. And sorry about that. And then we'll use all of that information and comment as we refine the regulations before they're adopted by this commission later this year, hopefully in the October timeframe. And throughout, you know, we'd like to thank the commission for your input and attention to this important topic, and we've also been working with the State Water Resources Control Board throughout this. What those phases look like on a timeline here, we're in August, marching through this process to really get into the details of the draft regulation that was posted July 17th, which opened a public comment period that will run through September 4th. We'll have those public meetings at the end of this month in early September. We then plan to summarize all the public comments we've received and report back to the commission next month, September, and give you an understanding of how we plan to revise or refine the regulations based on that public input. And then our goal is to bring the final draft regulations to the commission for adoption or consideration and adoption in the October timeframe. And then we'll have to do some administrative procedures with the Office of Administrative Law. And our goal is to hit that December 31st deadline, which we plan to open up the window for local agencies to submit these basin boundary revision requests within a 90-day window. And again, this is a critical component to the implementation of SGMA, as these local managers are trying to better align their basins as a first step in implementation of SGMA. So I mentioned the three public meetings we'll be holding. The first one will be in Sacramento, the end of this month. The next one will be in Bakersfield, September 2nd, and then Santa Ana on September 3rd. There's actually a fact sheet on the details of these public meetings and how to comment in the commission supporting information. And we really welcome feedback on these regulations. That feedback can come in the form of email or written comments or feedback at these commission meetings. And we are posting all of our comments online so anyone can see what comments have come in. So now we'll dive into the details of the regulation. So from here on out, I'd like to use a hybrid approach between the slides that you see in front of you and actually the regulation document. So just our first couple of slides to introduce why we're here and why we're writing these regs, or how the instructions for the regs really came from the SGMA requirements to establish this process for local agencies to change existing basin boundaries. And as I mentioned, the deadline for that, the adoption of these regs, is January 1st, 2016. In SGMA, there were four key components of information needed for local agencies to submit to justify a change. And local agencies is highlighted there because only local agencies can submit a request for the department. So in those areas where other entities are interested in revising boundaries, we encourage them to work with their local agency or contact the department, and we can help facilitate that discussion and coordination. So the four key components are all related to the sustainability or the likelihood of sustainability of the revised basin. So it's information demonstrating that the proposed new basin can be sustainably managed. It's the technical information on the boundaries and the conditions in that basin. And then a key component is the consultation with interested local agencies and public water systems in affected basins. And then finally, the catch-all of any other information that DWR deems necessary. So these regulations really took this framework or outline and added specificity to it. And also we created the methodology and criteria of how we're going to assess those four components. And the criteria, the overarching criteria for all of our assessment of the information submitted, is these three in front of you. The likelihood the proposed basin can be sustainably managed, whether the proposed basin would limit sustainable management in adjacent basins, and whether there's a history of sustainable groundwater management of groundwater levels in the proposed basin. So key points on the process in general. So our intent for these regulations is to match the intent of SGMA, and that is statewide sustainable groundwater management. So again, that's our lens we're looking through for all these basin boundary revisions. And we want this to be an open and transparent process. So we do not want any surprises at the local level that an entity is planning a basin boundary change and there's surprises that, you know, it's a surprise to someone. We want this to be open and transparent. Technical points, you know, as we all know, California has a complex hydrogeology, and the basin boundaries, the current basin boundaries, were last updated in 2003. So it's been quite a bit of time, and there's been a lot of additional study and reports out there that could be used to refine these existing boundaries. Those previous boundaries were used for voluntary planning, and there was a lot of good groundwater management occurring in California. It was voluntary. Now with the enactment of SGMA, it's required in the high and medium basins. So it makes these boundaries even more important of where they are. So all of this has left a varying level of detail in the existing data set and a high variability of potential modifications that the department will receive through this process. So we tried to create regulations that can capture that wide range of potential revision requests that can come to us. And finally, some administrative points. Only, as I mentioned, only local agencies can request modifications. And this whole process is a voluntary process. The existing basins and boundaries as they're defined can be used to implement SGMA. So this is an opt-in process where if local agencies feel they need to make a change, they can request the department do that. It's not required. So finally, the fundamental definitions of this is, what is a groundwater basin and a sub-basin? So a groundwater basin, and this is a slide presented in previous presentations, it's the whole three-dimensional aquifer system, alluvial aquifer system, or stacked series of alluvial aquifer systems that has a reasonably well-defined lateral boundary and a definable bottom. And so in that graphic on the right there, it shows the external boundary of the basin to non-basin material, and that has always been defined in previous Bulletin 118s with scientific information, and we have carried that tradition through into these regulations. However, the sub-basins, the internal lines you see at the lower graphic there, it's been a balance between scientific and jurisdictional reasons for defining those sub-basin lines on geologic and hydrologic conditions, but also institutional boundaries. So currently there are many basins. These internal sub-basin lines are on rivers or streams, but also on water agencies or county lines. And so that flexibility has been brought into these regulations as well. So now a quick summary of the regulation articles. So we organized this regulation by article to hopefully make it understandable, so you can go to the place in these regulations that you're most interested in or that affect you. So the first article is the introductory provisions. This is really stating our intent for these regulations. The second is outlining the definitions of what are the key terms used in this regulation. The third is the type of boundary modifications available for local agencies to submit to us. The fourth is the procedures for modification request or protest. So this is really the procedural aspects of how this process is going to work. And finally, or not finally, but really the major component of this regulation is Article 5. It's the supporting information. What instructions to local agencies or what information is needed to justify the particular change. Article 6 is then matching that. For each one of those pieces of information required, there's a criteria of how the department is going to evaluate it. And then finally, wrapping up, Article 7 is the adoption or the final, how we finalize the basin boundaries, and that's with publication in Bulletin 118 for them to be official. So now you've seen this graphic before, and we'll use this graphic to guide us through the draft regulation themselves. And so I'm referring to the July 17th draft, and that's available in the supporting information. And so Article 1, as I mentioned, it's really the purpose, the intent, and as I mentioned, the intent is to comply with SGMA and have statewide sustainable groundwater management. Also in Article 1, at the bottom of the page there, unless basin boundaries revisions are submitted to us, the boundaries will remain as they are. And this is just showing this graphic, GSAs and GSPs, or groundwater sustainability agencies and groundwater sustainability plans, can be developed in these existing basins. And those existing basins will be memorialized in the next update of Bulletin 118, which we're projecting to be published in the first quarter of 2017. And as I forgot to mention, that this whole process, our plan is to start this January 1st, 2016. Article 2 on page 2 of the regulation is the definitions, the key terms. And an important note here is that we're using the definitions that you see in the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act as well as Bulletin 118. So we refer to things, and they're defined in SGMA and Bulletin 118. We did not want to duplicate terms or definitions here. We wanted them to be in SGMA and Bulletin 118. And I should mention, at any point, if you have a question, please let me know. I'd like to get feedback on these. So Article 3, then, on page 5, it talks about the different categories of revisions. So the scientific and jurisdictional revisions. So scientific are those modifications based on geologic or hydrologic conditions that define the basin. The jurisdictional revisions are those that promote the adoption and implementation of effective sustainable management plans and that enhance local management of groundwater. So just because it says jurisdictional there, it doesn't mean it's only jurisdictional information. These types of changes can be rely on scientific and jurisdictional type of information. And then on page 6, there's a sort of catch-all other boundary modifications. So if for some reason something comes to us that doesn't really quite fit, the department has the authority to apply the appropriate requirements for that revision request. So really quickly, I'd just like to show, and we've seen this last meeting, the different types or a graphic of each type or example. So scientific can be those revisions to the external boundaries based on new geologic maps or technical studies, or the identification of a fault that restricts lateral flow, groundwater flow in the basin. There's three types of jurisdictional revisions. The first is internal. So this is sort of the minor snapping of lines from either a waterway to a county line or from a county line to a waterway. The second type of jurisdiction is consolidation, basin consolidation. This is when you're going from many basins to one, or where you're combining two or more basins, and we feel this is a potential advantage because you're increasing the management area and potential solutions or tools you have or the locals will have available to them. There's a special category where all of the contiguous aquifer material in a county could be consolidated into one basin. And what this could do is it could enhance or incentivize bigger GSPs that cover larger areas, which is also another potential advantage. And then finally, the last category is basin subdivision. This is going from one basin to many basins, where you're fragmenting an existing basin. And from the beginning, we've been messaging that this is a potential disadvantage in some cases. So there needs to be strong technical justification for this and local support for this, because fragmentation could lead to affecting adjacent basins or adjacent entities in that basin being fragmented. Now, Article 4 is the process, and now we're on page 7 and 8. So the eligibility to Section 343.2 is a local agency whose jurisdiction lies within or borders the basin or subbasin. Those are the ones that can submit changes for those basins. So the point of this is that some local agency in Southern California can't propose a basin boundary change for somewhere in Northern California. So it has to be, you know, in the area of their influence. Then another key point here is the status of the request. So when a local agency submits to the department, we will notify the department within 10 days that we received their justification or their submission, and we'll post that on our website. So this will be the first chance for local agencies to see the whole package of information, and it'll be transparent on our website. We'll then review that for completeness to make sure that it has all the required components, and then once we say that the department is ready to evaluate that starts a 30-day clock where these revision requests can be protested by any person. So any person can protest these, and all protests will be submitted or posted on our website so people can see what's being protested. However, the protests must rely on the same type of scientific or technical information that will be evaluated by the same criteria that the basin boundary request is. So it's a pretty high bar for the protest, and we're going to consider all protests in our evaluation. So Article 5 now, and there's in this graphic on the screen, the PowerPoint, there's three main components to the supporting information to justify these basin boundary changes. The first are information on the local agency. And those blue arrows represent stakeholder input opportunities. So as I mentioned, we want this to be open and transparent and multiple opportunities for stakeholders to be involved. So the Section 344.2, a key point here is that the requesting agency has to have a formal adoption by their board initiating this basin boundary modification process. So this provides a public meeting venue at the local level for locals to provide input. And then notification and consultation. And that's another opportunity for public input. And really there's roles and responsibilities for the requesting agency and for DWR. And as I mentioned, the board resolution is needed by the requesting agency. And then we're going to be looking for the methods that the local agency used to identify those affected or interested parties, what correspondence, the evidence of public meetings, and important public comments that came in. So the department can consider those public comments as we're evaluating these requests. So what we're going to do at the department is we're going to have an email notification service that people can sign up, and they will be emailed when we receive these requests in their area. We'll be posting all this information on our website and have tools, interactive maps and tables, where this information can be easily queried or looked at. So the second component of Article 5 is the local support. And there's a graphic here. And this is, for your reference, in the regulations, page 12. And as we've discussed before, there's a elevating of or a higher bar for different or the more severe basin boundary changes you're trying to make. So for jurisdictional, internal, it's just the local agencies affected by that change. Then basin consolidation, it's the majority of affected. And then basin subdivision, it's all local agencies and public water systems in the basin. And again, because of the severity of some of these fragmentations, we want to make sure that all local agencies are on board with that type of decision. And for every type of boundary change, there's that notification and public meeting requirement and the protest provision. So the remainder of Article 5 is really the technical information to justify these changes. And a key point here is this information, the department is looking for compilation of existing information, not new studies or that kind of thing. So that the information is out there. It's a matter of compiling it and linking us to it, linking the department to it. So the key components there are description of the basin boundaries, so that's the maps, GIS files, evidence of existing water management in the basin. So that is existing groundwater management plans, integrated regional water management plans, adjudications, all of that existing management structure that's in place. Hydrogeologic conceptual models. This is not a full-blown three-dimensional flow model requirement. If you have it, that's great, but this is more the understanding of the 3D structure of the aquifer. This type of information is out there already in many, many basins through Bulletin 118 and other technical studies. So again, it's compilation of existing information. And then for subdivision, it's historical and current conditions in the basin. What we're after there is we want to make sure the local agency understands the current conditions and of the basin that they're trying to fragment. So they're not isolating problem areas or areas of overdraft or water quality in a certain part of the basin. And then scientific, again, it's a technical study requirement of new geologic maps or that type of scientific information. Okay. There's the protest provision we mentioned earlier. So Article 6 on page 17 of the regulation is the how we evaluate the information provided to us. Right up front, there's a basis for denial of a request. And this has caused some concern or comment from stakeholders that they think if any one of these we see this, they'll instantly be rejected. However, we may deny a request for this, but what we're doing is we're gonna look at the whole package of information and we're gonna evaluate all of that information and to determine if it results in the likelihood of sustainable management. And that'll be our decision tree. There might be a place where it meets one of these one of these reasons for denial, but the whole package makes sense, and so we'll move forward that way. The remainder of Article 6 is just then the matching criteria applied to the related Article 5 methodology. And the department will come up with a draft list of draft approved basin boundaries. We'll post that on our website and have at least one public meeting to solicit comments. We'll then make any needed changes, and then we'll be presenting those draft recommendations to the commission. And that's a water code, new water code requirement. And so we'll be presenting to you all of those draft approved basin boundaries. We plan to give you a briefing sheet of why we approved them and any public comment that came in at the local level to DWR and any protests for each one. So hopefully that will expedite or make your review easier. And finally, Article 7, and really quick, the time frame on that, we plan to be before the Commission September 2016 with that information. And that's subject to change with the volume of requests we get, but that's our target, is to be in front of you in September. And our goal is to really expedite this whole process, because we know local agencies need to make these boundary changes in order to take future steps or subsequent steps in GSA formation and GSP development. So that's why it's a quick process here, or as quickly, we're trying to move as quickly as possible. So Article 7, as I mentioned, is really the finalization of these and official adoption of the basin boundaries, and that comes when they're published in Bulletin 118. So with that, I'll wrap up with some next steps. So we posted the regulations July 17th. That initiated that public comment process that will close September 4th. We'll have those public meetings to consider public comments. We'll be back before the Commission to summarize those public comments for you, to give you an understanding of what we've been hearing at the local level. And we'll plan to give you a summary of the planned refinements to the draft regulations based on those comments. Again, October, our plan is to bring the full package of information for your consideration and adoption in the October meeting, and then that will be followed by submission to the Office of Administrative Law to finalize that process. And all of that is really to hit our deadline, our target of January 1st, 2016, to let local agencies start submitting revision requests. And again, we plan to be back before the Commission September 2016 with that draft approval, the list of draft approved basin boundaries. So another attachment that's in the supporting information is, it's hard to see on the screen here, but from stakeholder input, we realized we needed to have a sort of a summary graphic of the roles and responsibilities for each interested party or required party. So the green bar at the top there is public input. So this lines out all the possible input opportunities for the public to be involved in this process. The yellow bar there is requesting agencies, so the roles and responsibility for them and the process through the regulations. And then DWR, all of our role and responsibilities. And then finally, the Commission there is, roles are in the purple at the bottom, just when we plan to be in front of you discussing this topic. And I know you have a very full agenda with the sort of the bigger project that you guys are working on, and that's the Water Supply Improvement Project or Program. And so, you know, we really appreciate your attention and feedback on these, and we're trying to get these things through with that input and take that input into consideration and try and get these things done by October to clear your calendar for this bigger project you guys are working on. So with that, thank you very much, and if there are any questions.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Okay.
Microphone's working.
Sorry. Yeah. Oh, yep.
I have a question. What has the flow of comments been like since you opened the public comment period, and what's the nature of those comments?
Okay, so we've received three official comments so far, and the nature of those comments have mostly been just minor edits or changes to wording that reflect some more updated, maybe, language. There has been some discussion on the local support, whether that's more burdensome than needed. So I have a feeling as the public comment process or comment period comes to a close, we'll start to get a lot more comments, and that will be a topic, a popular topic that we're getting comments on.
Commissioner Orth. And you mentioned those comments are available online if we want to see them.
Correct. Right. Yep, okay. On our Basin Boundary website, which the link is there on the screen now.
I appreciate the clarity of this. I want to emphasize to my fellow commissioners that this is pretty critical stuff, mm-hmm. in the middle of, you know, a time that we're really focused on the water storage investment program. But there is a lot of activity, as many of you probably know, at the local level that's dependent upon us getting through this quickly and with some clarity. I guess I had two questions for you, and maybe one is along the lines of the local agent or affected agency and affected system, and it's probably what you've already heard about, is in some of these larger basins, there are hundreds, literally hundreds, of affected systems and agencies. And as I read this, I think it reads that every one of those entities are going to have an affirmative obligation or affirmative obligation to show that that local agency or affected system agrees. And that's a pretty high bar. Maybe that was intended, and just I'm wondering about your thought of my interpretation.
Okay. Yeah, on that point, so you're correct that the all of the local agencies in the basin would need to support that change, and that that support comes in the form of a board resolution formally supporting. That's for basin subdivision. For internal changes, it's just the affected areas. So in that affected area, so if it's a small little change that affects three local agencies or public water systems, only those three would have to support. And then basin consolidation is a hybrid where there needs to be evidence that all were notified, but only a majority of those affected local agencies and public water systems would have to support. And there's a clause in the regulation where the whole package of information can be submitted to the department, and the evidence of local support can trail that submission, because we realize that's a high bar, or that could take longer. So as long as that comes in, we'll start to evaluate the request, and that can trail the request. So we tried to accommodate that with that section of the regulation.
I expect we'll hear more about that, but I'm not sure I object to the concept.
Okay.
I just think it's going to be one of those areas that we will hear about, just given the level of coordination that the local agency and affected systems are going to have to achieve. The other question I'll ask at this point is, I think you've identified protests and provisions for that fairly clearly. I'm wondering about whether or not, and I've read these several times and can't find, although I may have missed it, what happens when there are conflicting requests? Let's say you get three different local agencies that want to do something different with the basin boundaries. Is that, you feel that's clear in here? And if not, if so, could you point me that direction?
Yeah, and that's a really good point, critical point, because there could be conflicting, you know, requests at the local level for how they plan to move forward with SGMA and form their GSAs and GSPs. We try to handle that with in Article 4 on page 7, section 343.6, combination of requests. So there it says that the requesting agency, so one local agency has to take the leadership role and combine all basin boundary modification requests that affect the same basin or sub-basin. We have been getting some comment on this that could preclude two legitimate requests, or that could be burdensome. So we're trying to strategize, and your comments are very helpful, of how to maybe streamline this or provide a pathway for local agencies to submit multiple for the same basin. But again, what we don't want is that overlapping or conflicting, because that shows that there isn't coordination at the local level. And so we feel that that's best handled at the local level before it gets to the department to weigh in on which one is better. But so that's how we're handling it.
Yeah, and I would agree that it's up to the locals to figure this out. I think the regulations possibly could have some clarity that makes it very evident that if there are conflicts, the department's not going to move, the commission's not going to be put in a position to resolve those conflicts, but the local agencies need to resolve those before they are processed. I think, and I'm not sure that's terribly clear here.
Okay, yeah, and that's our preferred approach. And another sort of indirect reference to that is on Article 1, so the first page. Any discrepancies or uncertainties shall be resolved by the department based upon the best available technical information. So again, with the revision to clarify that process, if we do have two competing, that the department would use, look at which one will promote sustainable management and which one is based on the best scientific justification, I would imagine. But we still need to strategize on the best way to move forward with that. So we'll report back in September on that.
I just wanted to thank you for the presentation. You know, I agree with Dave, this is a very important topic, and it makes it much more easier for us as commissioners to understand what's going on when staff provide, very good presentations. So thank you for doing that. I agree with Dave's comments. I think that providing clarity on how the department will respond to conflicting requests is a good one. Perhaps we could offer the two options: one, that the locals resolve it before it comes, and then if not, then DWR has discretion to make the determination based on what the most available scientific information and so forth, so that this way we can still move along, but the locals know that it's much better if they resolve it at the local level.
Yeah, thank you for those comments, and that's a very good idea. And we'll work on that.
And I do. I also think that we are going to get a lot of comments on the high bar to getting support, but I'm glad that staff is recommending it. I think that it's very important. It creates incentives for there to be more targeted outreach and coordination, so I'm glad to see that in there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Steve.
All right, thank you, everyone.
Excellent presentation. And now, I agree with Commissioner Herrera.
And Trevor Joseph will be discussing the GSP regulations.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for having me. My name is Trevor Joseph. I'm with the California Department of Water Resources. I'm the project manager on the Groundwater Sustainability Plan regulations. So it's the next set of regulations, as Stephen mentioned. I'm just going to give a brief update today. We're about four to 5 months behind the the basin boundary regulations. We're required to have these adopted by June 1st, 2016. So we're on target, but we're a few months behind. Next slide, please. So specifically, I just wanted to give you an idea of the timeline again for these regulations, describe our outreach process, and give you a flavor of what we've been hearing. We're calling it the Summer of Outreach. We've done a lot of intensive scoping outreach this summer. And then briefly talk through just the input process and next steps. So you've seen this slide, I believe, before. I know you can't really read this. We do use this slide quite a bit to kind of put all of the SGMA activities into context and place them on the timeline. So the red box is just this set of regulations, the Groundwater Sustainability Plan regulations. As I mentioned, they're due by June 1st of 2016. A lot of those items in orange are DWR's responsibilities up front, and there's obviously a series of activities later along the process. So again, you've seen variations of this process before. We're using the same implementation process as basin boundaries. Here we're in the draft framework phase, the second phase. We've had a lot of scoping on the issues and challenges, and now we're really putting some discussion and topics around those issues and challenges. We'll move to drafting emergency regulations later this fall, and then again, adoption by our due date, June 1st, 2016. We're getting a lot of input and feedback from the State Board throughout this process. Where this process differs from basin boundaries is this draft framework process, we need a lot more time. The topic of groundwater sustainability plans is even more complex than basin boundaries. And so we need additional time to talk through items in depth with advisory groups and the public. And so we've set up a series of periods, I should say, from late June to mid-September to really have this outreach and discuss things more in depth before we move to drafting emergency regulations. As shown on this timeline, the orange boxes represent potential commission meetings. Obviously, we're here today during this outreach phase. We hope to be on the agenda again to describe just and continue to keep the commission up to date on what we've been doing. We're hoping to have the draft emergency regulations in front of the commission possibly December, maybe January. That date is subject to change. We need to figure out where we're at and make sure that it fits in with your schedule. That would then trigger a series of public meetings, just like basin boundaries that are required per SGMA, shown in the black box there, that would trail the date that we release those draft regulations, so either early next year, either January or February timeframe, and then again moving towards drafting, making final drafts, and sharing those comments with the commission, just like we're at with almost with basin boundary regs. I also wanted to highlight that we're doing a series of public meeting webinars on the discussions we're having this summer. We've already had one on July 20th. We have another one next week, August 27th, and finally September 21st. And I'll go into a little bit more detail in terms of the specifics on those meetings. So how we're handling outreach this summer is we've broken things up into smaller pieces or topics, and those topics are identified on this wheel. We are doing things in batches so that we can have meaningful discussion and dive into to depth on items and make sure that we give advisory groups and the public to an opportunity to really understand what the issues and challenges are we're hearing and share those issues and challenges with us. So we've done three batches here, or we have three different batches. I want to point out that we are just completed the second batch that are shown in orange. We have on our website discussion papers that go into detail in terms of the issues and challenges and some initial thinking on how to handle these topics in the groundwater sustainability plan regulations. We're a few weeks away from releasing the final discussion papers shown in green here on some very important topics. And then we'll have invite all those advisory groups again, set up that last public meeting, which is already set up, to dive into those topics in depth. A little hard to see, and honestly, I've lost count, but we always like to convey how many meetings we've had on groundwater sustainability plans and basin boundary regs. I think I've lost count. I think it's more than 75, certainly. I think David Gutierrez sometimes says 100. We do have an exact count somewhere, but it's we're having so many meetings that it's hard to kind of pin down the exact number on a day-to-day basis. The screen capture on the right is just showing where those discussion papers are on each topic. As I mentioned, the last four are not highlighted yet. They're not links yet. We're close to releasing those discussion papers, but they're on our website, on our groundwater sustainability plan website.
Quick question. So
yeah.
By meeting, you mean you've had a public meeting where you have invited people and publicized it, or what is that?
Yeah, good question. So the public meetings that we're having are not required per SGMA. Those are the mandatory public meetings are after the draft regulations are prepared. We're obviously not at that phase. We're having these discussion paper meetings. So with these batches, we have a series of advisory groups that we're meeting with after the release of each batch of discussion papers. And then we're also having a webinar public meeting to discuss, again, each of those discussion papers in batches, in three different batches. So we've had that first one July 20th, where we discussed the items in red there that I kind of briefly flashed up, those discussion papers. And we have, again, another public meeting webinar next week in Sacramento to discuss the items in orange that have been released on our website. And then we'll have that last one in about a month on the items that we have yet to post, the discussion papers in green that are not highlighted on this slide here.
So you've got essentially like a big list of people, and you do a blast out when you go to places, or you target certain groups in certain areas?
Yeah, it's a good question. We've done a series of blast either through public information officer. They've sent out notification. Notification goes out through our web server. And so we have a series of mechanisms to engage and reach out to the public. The webinar obviously provides an opportunity for those that can't attend in person. Our schedule is such that we haven't had time to really have a lot of those public meetings at each batch throughout the state. And so that's the reason for the webinar, is we do have that meeting in Sacramento and the webinar. And I think on the 20th, we had about 20 to 25 people in person, but over 300 on the webinar. So we thought that was pretty successful. And we had a lot of engagement through the webinar. So we felt like we got a lot of good information out of that meeting.
Mr. Dennis.
Hi, thank you. Just to follow on, I see that you've got the Los Angeles area identified, or at least what seems to be part of the Los Angeles area identified as a high priority. Can you give me a sense of what meetings you've had in this region and with whom?
Yeah, you know, I've given a presentation in Palm Springs on early Sigma implementation. Some of those other meetings, I believe David Gutierrez has met with, folks in the Ventura area. I'd have to go back to kind of our log to describe some of those other meetings. We had, with basin boundary regulations, we went to the San Bernardino Library and had a public meeting there as it relates to that early scoping when we're in that second phase of that project. And there's been some others, but I can't recall them.
And generally, the participants in the meeting are by category. You don't have to list the names.
Yeah, you know, they're mainly, I would call them practitioners, if you will. There are a lot of the water district managers, county representation. There are some NGO folks present at those meetings.
Okay, thank you.
Also, you mentioned advisory groups. Who are those advisory groups and how were they selected?
Yeah, good question. So I think we have about 12 advisory groups, and they range from, let's see if I can kind of quickly, I know they're on our website, but there's a practitioner group that is focused on local agency managers. We have an NGO group. We have a tribal group. We have an ag group. We have a Central Coast group. We have a Northern California Water Association is an advisory group. Aqua is an advisory group. CSAC and RCRC is another advisory group. And we have, San Luis Delta Mendota Water Authority and San Joaquin Tributaries Authority, and then Tulare Lake area is another advisory group. I think that's the majority of them.
And their role, does it come after the discussion papers, or do they help provide input so that the staff can develop the discussion papers?
It's after the discussion papers. So we've posted them, and we've invited the advisor groups and then having that public meeting to really dive into those in detail. The reason we feel this has been successful is the fact that we have, although it's a heavy lift to ask them to engage essentially three times this summer after each batch is done, by breaking them up into some smaller entities, I think we've really been able to dive in a little deeper than having very large meetings. We still have that opportunity with the public meetings, and we certainly will have that opportunity with the draft regulation public meetings. But I feel like we've gotten a lot of good input that might be more challenging to obtain if we had even larger meetings. So it's six and a half dozen. I mean, there's challenges associated with it in terms of everybody's time, commitment, but we do feel that it's helping us quite a bit. We felt that it helped us with basin boundaries.
Thank you.
All right, so just I have a couple more slides. I wanted to give you a flavor of what we're hearing at some of those advisory groups. This is going to be really hard to do because these discussion papers are rather dense, and the dialogue, as I was just mentioning, is fairly detailed. But just so you have an idea of what's being discussed and what the topics include. So again, we have six that have been released, what we're calling pre-Sigma conditions and undesirable results. We're spending a lot of time just making sure that we have defined sustainability and that we understand what baseline means. There's undesirable results listed in the Act. There's six of them: chronic lowering of groundwater elevations, water quality, storage, seawater intrusion, subsidence, surface water depletion. I think you're familiar with all of those. And so we're spending a lot of time talking about what site-specific differences there is in those and how to challenge it is from a local level to manage those conditions. So that's really topic one. Topic two, this has to get into a lot of the planning requirements specifically for Sigma. They have to provide measurable objectives, these local agencies in these groundwater sustainability plans, and interim milestones to measure progress at every 5 years. A lot of time here spent making sure that we understand how to approach those, how to measure progress is key, especially as it could potentially trigger state board intervention. Land use and county involvement, a very important topic that is mainly at the local and land use agency level, but again, very important for the success of Sigma. So this is a topic that we've been highlighting. Alternative GSP submittals. This is the one that we're not forgetting, but it's actually a separate set of regulations, emergency regulations, that have to deal with kind of specific opportunities for perhaps some local agencies that can show that they are already operating sustainably or have a groundwater management plan that essentially is functionally equivalent, that there's the potential that they can use this as an alternative to preparing a groundwater sustainability plan. So we're talking about the technical requirements that the department would need to see in order to agree with that sustainability. Boundaries, overlapping, and fringe areas. This is kind of a catch-all, not to be confused with what Stevens just presented. This has to deal with overlapping groundwater sustainability agencies and potentially overlapping planning or groundwater sustainability plans, the challenges created with that, and how to address that potentially in a governance-type requirement in the regulations. Fringe areas is a very unique case, more here in Southern California, where a special act district or an adjudication doesn't necessarily cover the entire basin or sub-basin. So how to handle these little odd fringe pieces, if you will, that don't fit within those jurisdictional boundaries. In many cases, they're 5% of the groundwater basin. So what is the appropriate groundwater sustainability plan requirements for those areas? If they're in a higher medium prior basin, they're still required to adhere to the Act, but how to approach these areas logically. And then finally, intra-basin coordination agreements. This here focuses on the actual intra-basin coordination agreement that's called out in the Act, which is two or more groundwater sustainability agencies completing two or more groundwater sustainability plans within the same basin or sub-basin. That is provided in Sigma, but there's also some discussion around interbasin between basins that are hydraulically connected. What's an appropriate type of coordination needed between those hydraulically connected basins? So not within a basin, but certainly the acts of one groundwater sustainability plan hopefully shall not interfere with another adjacent sustainability plan. So we're talking through that coordination.
Good question, Trevor. So the intra-basin could be multiple plans within one basin, or it could be sub-basin to sub-basin agreement?
We often use basin, sub-basin interchangeably, and it gets kind of confusing, but intra-basin coordination is any case where there's two or more groundwater sustainability agencies that choose to complete two or more groundwater sustainability plans in the same basin or sub-basin.
You have to have an agreement, though, between sub-basins, right?
You have to have agreement if there's multiple plans within that sub-basin.
But what if you have a basin that has two sub-basins in it? Is it required? My understanding is I thought it was required that there be...
Intra-basin is not required, if I understand you correctly, intra-basin is not required if a GSA decides to complete a groundwater sustainability plan for one sub-basin and then there's another adjacent sub-basin and another entity decides to do the exact same thing. intrabasin doesn't apply in that case. But interbasin, and it, we probably should have used a completely different looking word.
So subbasin then is can be a self-contained.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. But we still think that it's important to talk about interbasin then. If they're hydraulically connected,
right.
The department, there's a provision that we have to, I think it's 10,733, that plans cannot adversely affect other adjacent plans. And so there's a need for what we're calling interbasin coordination. So we're talking about what's appropriate from a local agency stakeholder perspective, because it's not explicitly labeled in the Act.
Thank you.
And then just my final slide is again, this is on our website, but I just wanted to highlight the public meeting webinars that are coming up for first the batch two again, which I stated is next week, and then batch three, which is September 21st. So for those that are interested, certainly an opportunity to talk through the specific topic papers and discussions that we're having.
Great. Thank you very much, Trevor. Commissioner Orth.
Not a question so much as a comment. I continue to be very impressed and amazed with the department's organization and clarity here. I mean, this is such a heavy lift in such a short time period. Trevor, I know that you and a lot of people are working on this, and I think you've done a great job in kind of structuring this in a logical flow, giving, you know, the stakeholders early opportunities to look at, which should make the commission's job easier when we finally see the regs later this year. So again, good stuff, and thank you for your effort. I think you've reached out early, and that will be helpful, I believe. I will say on the interbasin coordination discussion, I think a lot of the locals are starting to get that even with boundary adjustments, the connectivity is such that some level of understanding of how subbasins interrelate with each other is critical. So I think that'll be one of these things that as we get deeper into that topic, that will be interesting to see how we frame that so it's helpful and informative to local agencies, but not a burden that makes it more difficult to manage groundwater. So thank you for a good job.
Appreciate it. All right, thank you.
Questions? Okay, thank you, Chairman. And I also want to echo the good work of the department. I think the public outreach, as you can tell from the questions as well, is super important and will make our job a lot easier. So anyway, thank you. Okay, moving on to the next item on the agenda, which is number 9. Prior to that, I'm going to say hello to Sue Sims out there, former executive director. I'm not sure if she was recognized earlier, but in a different role down here. Welcome. Okay, now we've got Mary Scruggs. Welcome, Mary. Thank you for coming. You're going to talk about the critically overcrafted basins list.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Folks in trouble.
Folks in trouble, no. So I'm going to give an update on, it's an information update for the commission on critically overdrafted basins. Due to time constraint, it's going to be very brief, but we are having a public meeting next week, so there will be more information, and you'll find out about that. So basically, critically overdrafted basins, the department's required to identify them because of the water code under SGMA. And under section 12924, it says the department, I'll cut it out, will identify basins that are subject to critical conditions of overdraft. So this applies to all the high and medium priority basins under SGMA. And basins, the ramifications of this is the basins that are identified as critically overdrafted is they have to submit their groundwater sustainability plan by January 31st, 2020, which is 2 years before the other plans are due. DWR is using the term critically overdrafted basins to refer to what's in the code as basins subject to critical conditions of overdraft. And the reason we're doing that is subject to conditions of can be something that could be happening or may not be happening. So we're looking at it as being what's actual reality or what happened. So we're calling them critically overdrafted basins, and it's also shorter, so we can come up with a cool little acronym. DWR hasn't updated this since 1980. In Bulletin 18-1980, 11 basins were identified, and they were done with cooperation with the local agencies. Bulletin 118 update 2003 came along. We didn't update that list. We just used the same basins. The basin boundaries had been changed, and so the list looks different, but it's still the same areas that were identified in 1980. No new issues. Bringing us back to current, so Sigma came along and now we're required to identify it and we have funding to go through and do it. So now we came up with a plan on how to identify the critically overdrafted basins. We developed a way to determine the base period, and the base period would include wet and dry times. We conferred with a state climatologist. We also wanted the longest period we could have to try and get a better data record. And we also wanted the base period to have the same mean precipitation as long-term mean. And we're also applying it statewide, so the best we could do. And we ended up having a base period of 1989 to 2009. So we went back and we evaluated all the basins, not just high and medium, using the data that was available, groundwater elevation data available at DWR for that time period. And come to find out, we had very limited data, and there were about 400 basins that we didn't have data for that time period. The CASGEM data was not used because CASGEM period data didn't start. It was outside our base period time, so it started afterwards, and it was in the drought period. So we need to go back and reevaluate, and I'm not sure if I said it before, but we're also using, in that base period, it's areas outside the period of drought. So CASGEM in the last recent four-year drought is not included within this evaluation. So going back and looking at our evaluation to see what we could do, since we were so lacking in data in so many places, we came back and we said, okay, Bulletin 118, 1980 basins that were listed, you stay on the list until we find out if there's information that we don't really have a reason to take it off yet. And then we also were asking local agencies if they were on that list, that if they had data they could provide to us to evaluate to show that they aren't critically overdrafted during our base period, then we would be open to and reevaluate that. We also went back and we conducted a review of available reports, DWR reports, region office investigations, USGS reports, published reports, local agency reports, or groundwater management plans and EIRs. And so with that, we wanted to go through and see if we could identify basins with significant and unreasonable impacts as identified under Sigma. So we reviewed that information to identify these areas of the significant, unreasonable, undesirable results, and not just the mere presence of undesirable results. So we're looking for the very extreme end of critically overdrafted, not overdrafted or not everything's fine. So when we went back and looked at those, there's of the undesirable results, there were four reasons that we've identified basins on our list. So it's chronic lowering of groundwater levels, significant and unreasonable seawater intrusion, significant and unreasonable land subsidence, and significant and unreasonable degraded water quality. So the basins we have identified could have one or more of those undesirable results. So when we put together our preliminary or initial list, we came up, as we said, we had all the basins from Bulletin 118, 1980, but we listed them as being in the current basin boundaries from update 2003, and then the basins we added from our review. Back in July, DWR staff contacted all the major water districts, the basin managers, and the respective counties of the basins that are listed on our preliminary list to let them know that we identified them as critically overdrafted, and we wanted to give them a heads up and also the opportunity to see if they had data that we didn't have we could reevaluate. We followed up with many of those agencies, and there's still a couple we're still waiting to follow up with, but we evaluated some of them, and we've come back now. The list that we show that we're releasing today is now our draft list that we've gone through that preliminary information. And basins that are on the list, it should not be a surprise to them because they're already aware of it. And that data that was provided, if DWR had that data available, those basins would never have made it on the list initially. So that brings me to the information that I put in the packet. So there's three maps. One is a statewide map, and then we have a map of the basins by our regions. So the North Central has one basin, and the South Central has more of them there on the second map, and then the third map shows our Southern Region office. So the basins identified in purple are the critically overdrafted basins of our draft list. There's 21 basins total, and one basin straddles two DWR region offices. So if you total the numbers on the individual maps, it's going to say 22 instead of 21, but that one basin, most of it's in the southern region, but there's part of it in the south central region. All the basins we identified are in the higher medium priority basins of under the prioritization. And 21 out of 127 basins total. Area-wise, it's About 40% of all the high and medium priority basin area is on our critically identified basins. So breakdown within our regions, and as you'll see it from the state map that's in your packet, there's no basins in the northern region. There's one basin in the north central region, which is abutting basins on the 16 basins in south central region office, and the southern region office has five basins. The basins not identified as critically overdrafted could be overdrafted or they could be fine, but we did not go out and look for overdrafted. We looked for the critically overdrafted extreme. And due to the current drought conditions that have been happening, some of those basins that are critically overdrafted or maybe that are overdrafted, they could be in that condition. As I said, we only looked at the base period. So that brings us to our next steps. We have a press release that should be going out about 20 minutes ago today that would have, but we're releasing, it's the information talking about this and that we're here. And then we will also post more information on the website. This is a really brief summary. We have a webcast and a meeting scheduled next week. The public meeting will be on the 25th in Clovis. And we have a webcast scheduled for the next day. Due to technical issues, we couldn't schedule them together. That meeting will include more in-depth information about our process, the background, the basins we came up with, the reasons for it, and our next steps. Can't get into it too much on a quick update here. We will be posting those maps, the information, and on the website, and we want people to come to the meeting and hear the whole story behind how we arrived at what we came up with. The public comment period, we're giving we're going to send a 30-day comment period after the public meeting, so that would take it to September 25th. At that point, we will accept comments from the public or from, as well as from local agencies that we've already contacted, and we need information or data, and that can deal with either a basin that's already on the list that they feel that should not be there and we want to see the data to support why it should be taken off the list, or if there's basins that we don't have information that people feel should be listed as critically overdrafted both ways. But we would need that information, that data, to be able to support that determination like we did to come up with our original draft list. We will, depending upon the extent of our comments, we'll review the comments and the data, and we hope to finalize the list in October. How early or late will depend upon the volume of information we have. And as I said, we still have a couple areas that we still need to meet with the local agencies on some of their data. So there may be some changes, but we'll see what comes in. We will publish the final list once we've made that determination on the website. The Water Code, we're required to publish that in the Bulletin 118 update in order to make them critically overdrafted basins. Bulletin 118 update will not be happening until later next year, so we expect it to be in the Bulletin 118 update coming out in later 2016, but the information that gets published in Bulletin 118 will be the same basins that we finalize come this October will be on the website. And when we go to the public meeting and what we've also extended, we did, as I said, we've notified the local agencies that are impacted and the counties, and DWR welcomes comments from the public and from local agencies and the data to be able to support to either include more basins or to take basins off. And if we go to the next maps, I can show the, it'll show a blow up of, by the area, you can see it. Do I have a clicker? Oh, sorry. Never mind. I'll do it. Oh, I went too fast. Sorry. So these are the basins from the predominantly south central area, which is essentially the San Joaquin Valley. And then the one basin outside the boundary is the one that's in the north central region area, which is the eastern San Joaquin Basin. And you can still see on the not as dark purple are the some of the basins that are in the southern region area. And then here's the southern region area, and there's a few basins down there. And then we also included the list, which I know that people in the audience can't read this, but there is the packet of the list which names the basins and the sub-basins and how they got on there. And that's critically overdrafted basins in a very short amount of time.
In a nutshell. Well, thank you very much, Mary. I want to just start myself real quickly and say that what you provided is super helpful as far as just laying it out. And I know that this is different than what we're required to do with regulations, so it's nice of you to bring it to us. And also, I appreciate all the public effort and outreach that you guys are doing, which I know So you're treating this as more of a public process when you're not necessarily required to do it as much. I think that's very smart, and this is super helpful. I think you're doing a great job. So I'm going to, I have questions, but I'll open up the other commissioners first. Commissioner Orth, and then anybody else? Commissioner Daniels after that.
I echo Commissioner Burns' comments about this. I am trying to process, and maybe you can help me with this. And this is relevant because these are the basins that will have to do groundwater sustainability plans by 2020.
Correct.
The balance of the high and medium priority basins, so-called, from the CASGEM process have until 2022.
Correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you mentioned that this is about 40% of the, was it high or high and medium?
High and medium. 40% of the total area.
Okay. All right. So that's helpful. I'm trying to process, and maybe I have to go back and just look at the 8 or 9 criteria for CASGEM prioritization and compare it to the criteria that you used in critical overdraft. But there are now, by virtue of this, some high priority designated sub-basins that won't have to do a sustainability plan until 2022 because their high prioritization is not a function of critical overdraft. It's a function of something else. I don't know what that is. And do you have
Can
to
I
know?
Try and address that?
Yes.
So in the basin prioritization, there were 8 criteria that were spelled out in the water code that we did under CASGEM, and then we adopted that same prioritization, those final results, under SGMA. So critically overdrafted or overdrafted, those undesired results, it was before that terminology had come out because that part of the code hadn't been written, that would be falling under category or item 7 or 8. So it would be one category or one criteria out of the 8. The other criteria in the basin prioritization, what it really is it's a prioritization and it's really based on importance or water, groundwater reliance. So you've got groundwater use, you've got population, you've got irrigated acreage, you've got number of wells. So you put all that together, and as far as what we're looking at here for critically overdrafted for really adverse impacts, it's only in one of those criteria. The prioritization that was done under CASGEM and that is now part of, you know, how it's determined by SGMA is not a reflection on how a basin is being managed, whether it's being managed well or not being managed well. It's a reflection of how important groundwater is. And those high and medium priority basins, based on the data that we had, ended up being that it covers 88% of the overlying population and it covers 96% of the groundwater being used in the state. So that is where groundwater is critical throughout the state. So when we went back and we did critically overdrafted basins, and understand as we're going along, we're now getting more data than we had. When we did the basin prioritization, we didn't have some of this data because we used what we could and what we could find. So looking at that, we were looking at really undesirable, extreme, you know, worst case, and issues we came up, you know, subsidence, chronic overdraft or lowering of the water levels, degradation of the groundwater, you know, in some cases you could have multiple things. So it's there. You could, to expect all the high priority basins to come in as critically overdrafted wouldn't be right because it's not your, it's a importance of groundwater. So if you have a highly important basin and it's being managed well, one would not expect it to be critically overdrafted. And ideally, we'd like all those basins, none of them to be critically overdrafted. So, but the one part where I do caution is we looked at it for our base period. So it's outside the drought. So I expect we may get some comments saying, you know, this basin and this is what's happened. You know, we've had, you know, 4 years of drought and it's dropped here. That's outside our base period. We're looking at it outside it, and that's what the code said. That doesn't mean those areas don't have problems, and it doesn't mean that the other basins other than the 21 don't have issues to deal with, but these are the critically overdrafted. So does that help?
Mr. Daniels.
Thank you. I have, again, a comment and a question. I guess I'll give the comment first. It's just, thank you for this information. It's just hard for me to wrap my head around the fact that we have ongoing and irreversible subsidence in 2 of these basins that are significant rate. And I just need to say that. I know it's It's a little out of the purview of what you're being asked to do in terms of addressing that, other than identify these basins at the moment and accelerate their planning. But I hope that at some point in time we can maybe have a conversation about that. It would be informational, I understand, but I think it might be worthwhile. But the question I have is about your criteria. You added one to the handout that we have here, the four criteria that show evidence of overdraft. You mentioned chronic lowering of groundwater levels, significant and unreasonable three times in terms of seawater intrusion, lead subsidence, and water quality. And I'm just wondering if you could amplify for us how you interpret those terms and what informs your interpretation of those terms, significant and unreasonable.
When it comes down to on like subsidence, I want to get to my list here. You shouldn't have subsidence. And in the cases what we have, there's areas that we're talking, 6 inches to a foot or more of subsidence during the base period. So if you're seeing that kind of subsidence, they're critically overdrafted. They got put in there, assuming that it was in the base period. Okay, so there's other areas that there's probably subsequent that's happening that may not have made it on this list, or there's areas that it's continuing that they're already on the list. Chronic lowering of the groundwater levels, we pull out the data and we look at the hydrographs, and you see groundwater levels dropping. You would expect that if it's sustainable or being managed, it would fluctuate, and it would fluctuate seasonally or in dry years. It could drop down and come back up again. But in the cases, what we have is showing, and we're talking over, multiple years. It's not a one-year drop, and it's not, a foot. It's going to vary within the basin because these basins can vary from very large areas. They're, deep alluvial aquifers to coastal basins and stuff. But it's the chronic dropping of it. The seawater intrusion, if you have your groundwater dropping, and so you'd have your freshwater aquifer would be your groundwater source, and you have the sea over here, and if you're dropping groundwater levels in and now seawater's coming in
right.
and intruding, that's a bad thing too.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm getting at is that those terms seem like terms of art. You can have terms of art like reasonable and beneficial use and another, type of decision making. And in this case, you're using these words as terms of art, so I'm just wondering how you arrive at them and decide.
The references we have for all of them, we have...
It's in the code?
No, it's not in the code. But when we went back to go look at either the data we have or we look at the published reports, in some cases there's agencies that said in their EIRs or in the groundwater management plan that they're critically overdrafted. It's been going on for, X number of years or something. So for each of those basins, we could come back and say what they are and why they are. And that's when we went to the local agencies and said, okay, here's what's listed. This is why it is. This is what we have. Do you agree or not agree, or do you have something to show us different? That's what we came up with. So it's...
Something you're using to help guide your own decision making.
Yeah, but it's not a matter of is it just barely present. These are, they're over here.
But it's a retrospective judgment call you're making.
It is, but it's it's on the extreme end.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
And I don't think it wasn't when we're going through and doing this. It's not like we see this a continuum and it's like this nice balance and here we go and suddenly we chop it off and here go here. You're over here. Okay, these are bad. These may have some issues or something like that. So it was pretty, with the exception of one or two, it was pretty easy that clearly these are unreasonable, extreme, significant. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, thank you, Mary. I have just one quick question.
Okay.
So when you do the list and you finalize it, I get that for purposes of Sigma, it has the significance of the accelerated timeline. But is it something that goes into Bulletin 118 anyway? And I don't know whether there's other significance other than being identified as critically overdrafted. Are you going to be looking at them periodically and taking people off the list as they improve, or
well,
does it matter?
In the past, DWR, we'd been tasked to do this, and so we didn't get funded to do it. So then under Sigma, we were required to do it, and we needed to do it because there's a deadline to get it published in Bulletin 118. Plus, those agencies need to know if their plan is due in 2020 or 2022. So this is looking at it statewide. The way I see what would happen is, okay, these have been identified critically overdrafted, but they fast forward to where they have their plans. They should be evaluating where they are in their sustainability plans. And so they, are they critically overdrafted? Are they making progress? Or are they going in? Are they agreeing? So it should be showing up in all those plans as they come in. DWR could go and compile those results and say, okay, there's improvement here or whatever. But in the past, that's never been done. So I don't know that we would really do this task again. It is here. They're going to be in here. It's during the time period of what it is. But they should, hopefully everyone should be moving out of that, and it becomes, you know, you hit overdraft and then you come back and it's being balanced. So I don't see it, but we do have to do it in order to have, the way the code is written and the way I got it from our legal office is, in order for it to have it set that they have to have their plans in, we have to publish it in Bulletin 118. But we want to get that information out first, so we'll put it on the website.
Got it. Okay, yeah, it makes sense to me that now they're going to be interacting with the state board on whether they're complying with their plan or not. So relevance is not.
Or ideally, if they're not, they don't. The state board doesn't take in, but they move forward, and so then it would, you know, everyone should know where the status of their basin is as it goes along. Okay.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Mary, and thanks for coming down. So real quickly, I was remiss in the last item number 8. I wanted to give, not for you, Mary, but just in general, if there's an opportunity for public comment on both items 8 and 9, which are all kind of related. I don't know if there's anyone who would like to do so, but if you would, now would be the right time on those two items. And I will have public comment after every other item as well. So anybody? Sure. Yeah, just come on up. Welcome.
My comment is more of a question for Ms. Scruggs, related to the critically overdrafted basins.
Quickly just identify yourself.
Sure. Corrine Mandelbaum, Environment Now. And it has to do with the justification for leaving out the period of drought. We understand that there have been many more wells drilled during this period because of reductions in surface water deliveries, and because there's still an opportunity to continue to drill wells unregulated before SGMA is enacted. So I imagine that many of those basins where they've already been experiencing overdraft and they are now subject to potentially more overdraft because more wells are being drilled and pumped, would fall into this critical level if they hadn't been before. So, thank you.
I see Mary coming. Thank you for your comment.
So the reason the basins that are not included during the current drought is because the water code under SGMA specifically states it. So we use the definition for undesirable results in a water code section 10721W. Let me see where it says, overdraft during a period of drought is not sufficient to establish a chronic lowering of groundwater levels if reduction in groundwater levels or storage during a period of drought are offset by increases in groundwater levels or storage or other periods. So we kept out the drought period. And part of that also is during drought, groundwater ends up kind of being that buffer zone. So if you don't have your surface water, you'd use your groundwater to fill that in. Now, in some cases where you've already overdrafted your groundwater during regular periods and now you're in drought, it's even more. It doesn't minimize that there's not an issue there, but for what we were defined to do, or you know, what we were tasked to do for defining critically overdrafted basins with respect to SGMA, it was outside drought period.
Okay, thank you, Mary. And an interesting point, too, because obviously accelerated overdraft is likely to occur in those areas, so good comment. Okay, thank you again. Move on to item number 10 on the agenda, which is get into our water storage and investment program. Ms. Jenny Marr. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the commission. We have our working session this afternoon, so I'm going to keep these two presentations brief. But I do have a quick update on administrative activities and our communications and engagement. So our administrative updates, based on our adoption of your adoption of the goals, objectives, and principles document at the last meeting, the document's been posted on the commission website as final. We updated the issue working session topic schedule, and that's the 11 by 17 table in your packet. We'll go over some of the items in there in a little bit more detail this afternoon. We finalized the scope of work for a new consultant contract that's making its way through the state approval processes. Our existing consultant contract expires in November, and this current scope of work for the next contract will include support for finalizing the regs, meeting support for our outreach activities, technical support decision support, our decision support for developing the decision support tool, and application review and technical analysis as needed during the review process. So our work groups have been very busy in the last couple weeks. Our regulations work group is circulating an internal working draft of the regulations text. We've got a good draft that will be reviewed over the next week internally to be provided to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee at the next meeting. So the first week in September, we'll be unveiling our first draft, and it's the working draft of our regulations text. They're also working on the informative digest and the initial statement of reasons. Those two documents will join up with the regulations text for the rulemaking package that's submitted to the Office of Administrative Law. We're working on drafting the application guidance document. So this will be a document that provides all the necessary information for applicants to fill out the application. It also will include some technical guidance. And we're currently scoping the application review process and looking at staffing and budget needs for the upcoming years when we're actually looking at the applications and doing our technical reviews. Our engineering team has been supporting the development of the regulations text. They've been working on a proposal for integration studies, which we'll touch on at the issue working session. This is really just a documentation of things that have already been discussed, but we'll talk about it in a little bit more detail this afternoon. We've been refining the physical common assumptions document, and that document was shared with the Stakeholder Advisory Committee at the last meeting in August. And we're presenting it for your review at the issue working session. And they've also been working on a draft technical guidance appendix for the application package. And the guidance package will really be a joint document of the physical common assumptions, the economic common assumptions, and the tools and methods document that was completed a few years ago. That'll be updated and rolled into this technical guidance document. The economics work group have been busy refining the common assumptions for economic analysis, a document of our working draft, kind of documenting where we're at on these, was presented to the SAC at their August meeting. We're incorporating comments from the SAC and, again, rolling this document into the larger technical guidance. They're also busy working on the recommended unit values of water. And again, these are not required, but we are providing technical guidance for unit values of water just to provide some support to potential applicants. And again, they're working on the economic guidance for the application package. Our ecosystem and water quality work group is refining and finalizing priorities and relative value. At the last meeting, you heard from Department of Fish and Wildlife and State Water Board on their current drafts of the priorities and relative value. They've been working to refine those and are working with their management and executive chain of command to get those approved for incorporation into the draft regulations. We're hoping that they're able to work through their chain of command and get their latest drafts into our September working draft of the regulations text. And they're also working on potential metrics and units to be able to measure the support of various projects to the priorities. So update on communication engagement, unless there's any questions on the administrative update. Okay. So moving on. Quickly on just a snapshot of our CNE updates, we conducted a state and federal coordination meeting, our August Stakeholder Advisory Committee meeting, and three public meetings. Summaries of all these meetings are included in your packet. The state and federal coordination meeting was attended by approximately 15 state and federal agencies that are listed on the slide. We thought we had really good participation and a good cross-section of potential operators and permitters of projects that would apply for funding through this program. We received mostly questions on process and schedule, and a handful of questions on coordination with other programs in the federal government. Our SAC meeting, we covered the draft common assumptions for physical and economic analysis, existing compliance obligations and how they could be considered by the commission during the project review process. We introduced the formal rulemaking process and kind of gave some expectations for what's going to happen over the next year with the draft regulations text. We started discussion of the draft regulation text, and we provided an early preview of the monitoring and management of public benefits section of the regulations text. We had a discussion of groundwater storage and conjunctive use definitions, and we've included a handout in your packet of the staff proposal of groundwater storage and conjunctive use definitions. And included on that in red line strikeout are stakeholder advisory committee comments. All the materials that we talked to the SAC about, we've asked them to provide red line strikeout if they wanted it included for this meeting by last Monday. And if they didn't get input it by that time, we asked them if they just like to do comments by comment letter to do that by last Wednesday so we could make copies for your packets, and there are three comment letters in your packet on materials that were handed out, two on the existing compliance obligations, and one covered a lot of different topics from the meeting. Again, a lot of this was draft, so we told them, if you want information, provide it to the commission for the August meeting. That's the timeline in which we need it, but the comment period is still open for SAC members for any of the materials that we're currently working on. Based on the issue working session at the last meeting with the commission members, we had some questions about quantifying recreation benefits, and we went back to the stakeholder advisory group and asked them the following questions. How should applicants be required to quantify recreation benefits? Is monetized value per user day appropriate? Are there other methods you're aware of? Are there recreation benefits that cannot be monetized, and how should the commission consider them? So the feedback we received is recreation benefits, although they're a public benefit for our chapter of Proposition 1, they're generally not a primary benefit, and the expectation is that recreation is going to be a smaller component of any of the projects that are submitted. So a lot of the stakeholders felt utilizing standard economic practices and having some qualitative assessment was sufficient, and that's the same with any of the other public benefit categories where we'll monetize to the maximum extent possible and provide qualitative analysis where we can't monetize. Staff was asked to look at other state agency recreation grant programs for guidance, and we will do that before we finalize the draft regulation text. And most members of the SAC felt that a monetized value per user day was appropriate for considering recreation benefits, but there also should be a process for the commission to consider underserved communities and recreation benefits in those areas and providing a variety of recreation opportunities in an area. So our next stakeholder advisory committee meeting, the agenda will include a further discussion of common assumptions and technical guidance. We're going to roll that discussion into a walkthrough of the draft regulations text. So the majority of the meeting will be walking through the draft text of the regulation. An early kind of opening up the door discussion of potential metrics and units, an update on this meeting, and summary of all the stakeholder advisory committee comments that we received from the August SAC meeting. So again, we held three public meetings in July and August, one in Napa, another in Davis, and the latest one in Bakersfield. We had 20 to 30 attendees at each meeting. Interests ranged from project eligibility and program goals to decision process and future funding decisions, such as how will the commission make their funding decisions? Are they going to make a decision that a certain amount of money will be eligible for each project type, or will money be distributed across regions in any manner? So there was some interest in that area. And in Bakersfield, a lot of comments and questions were received on the Temperance Flat project and ensuring that this process included a net increase in water supply, particularly in that region. So coming up for communication engagement, we've got the September and October commission meetings, the September stakeholder advisory committee meeting, and then another series of public meetings in October. Those public meetings will be held in Fresno, Yuba City, and Pleasant Hill, and will all go from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. in those locations. But the locations, the specific locations, have not been identified yet. Any questions?
Mr. Daniels?
Since I asked you to ask about recreational benefits, I want to publicly thank you for taking my question to the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. I do see that we ended up in the same place where we started even before I asked the question, but I appreciate the fact that you went back and got some feedback, because I think that was the point of the question, and I thank you for presenting it in the way that you did.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Got one, Jenny. So do you think that people are getting it, what we're doing more? I mean, obviously, all these folks are vested in the advisory group, but on the other general outreach, seems like we're not getting too many people. It's still good that we're going. And I know that we're talking about communication strategies for larger efforts and stuff like that, but
it doesn't sound like a lot of people that attending the public meetings, but it's a smart group of people, and it's people who are really engaged in the process, and they're asking questions about the water storage program, and they seem very committed to following the process and ensuring that it's done well. So I think it's we're getting good participation from the right people.
Jenny, I noticed that the agenda for the August 5th SAC meeting had the human right to water item in there, and I didn't see any anything in the meeting summaries about what the stakeholder group, any feedback that they provided to staff. Did that item remain on the agenda, and was there any discussion on that?
I'll have to look into that, because I don't recall having a human right to water agenda item for the August 5th meeting. We talked about it at the June meeting, but I'll have to look into if there was an agenda item that we may have missed.
Yes, because I actually got that email from Paula saying that it was on in. So, she said that it was going to be discussed, and that, the meeting summary would include the minutes of what, and I went and I was unable to locate it, so I was just wondering.
Yeah, okay. Jenny just had it as an item, as an update item, and there was not a discussion of it.
Okay.
That's what generated my email to Maria. Yeah.
Okay.
Questions? Okay, thank you, Jenny.
Okay.
I should say, any public comments on that item? This is number 10. Number 11 is pretty similar. Oh, I'm sorry, that's it. Okay, great. So last chance for public comment before a lunch break, and we'll reconvene at 1 o'clock. Anybody? Yeah, okay, so we're going to take a break here. We're going to reconvene in room US-2-145, where we're going to have our working group session on a number of issues on the WSIP program. So that's, once again, room US-2-145. So we're officially going to take a break, and that will reconvene at 1 o'clock. All right.